Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
A wing and a prayer. How to claim compensation if you were caught up in the British Airways systems meltdown. Could your family finances survive redundancy? And you might love your ISA, so why is Paul Lewis of Moneybox fame arguing that it's time to scrap the tax-free savings accounts? Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast about personal finance and investing. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, bringing you this week's money news in downloadable form. There were scenes of chaos at airports over the bank holiday weekend as the start of the half-term holidays coincided with a major systems outage at British Airways. Up to 75,000 passengers were affected, and the compensation bill is estimated to run into hundreds of millions pounds. But if you were caught up in the chaos, how will you get your hands on that money? I'm joined in the studio by Helen Judney, the consumer champion and author of How to Complain, the essential consumer guide to getting refunds, redress and results. She's better known as the Complaining Cow, which is the name of her popular website and blog, and she's certainly been scraping her hooves about British Airways this week. Welcome, Helen.
Hi.
So, how do you think British Airways have handled this crisis?
Very badly, in short. I think it's been an absolute debacle, hasn't it? I think the CEO has a lot to answer for. He took his time coming out to apologise. And then when he did so, sort of on social media, he was there in his fluorescent jacket and not actually giving passengers all the information that they needed. There was a huge amount of criticism about not having the information. There was a huge lot of criticism, and still is, about the BA not giving information about what their rights are, whether they're flying through Europe or not. They all have rights and they weren't being given them at all.
So what can people who have been affected by this claim back, and how do you rate that against the official advice BA has been giving customers so far?
Well, BA's advice has been very limited. They have eventually sort of been giving out letters, but that doesn't actually tell them about the compensation that they're due if they have been flying in the EU, which is the set amount of about 250 to 600 euros, depending on the length of delay and the length of the flight. But that's in Europe. But even if you're not flying in Europe, you're certainly entitled to your accommodation if you've had to stay overnight somewhere, the travel to and from that accommodation or home, and certainly for refreshments and food. That's certainly the legal advice, and they've been given that out sort of very unwillingly. And also, if they're challenged, then they're giving it. But also, under the contract regulations, they also have to be providing a helpline number that's not a premium rate. And it's come to light again that they've been using a premium rate, so they're actually making money from people phoning up, trying to get compensation, or even just trying to get information. And they have now said they will refund that money. But I'm always about, I know how many people know their rights, and it's very few. And of those, how many of them will claim? So I say very cynically that BA will actually have made some money. They would have got some money back on those phone lines, because a lot of people will not claim their money back on that.
And the onus is on you as the customer to claim back the costs of these flight disruptions. There's no automatic program, even though so many thousands, tens of thousands of people are affected, which will save them the hassle. They have to do it themselves.
That's right. You have to write to customer services. Again, if you don't get any joy from customer services, if you're not happy with their response or they're taking too long, I always advise putting in your letter when you want a response by. That'll, you know, speed things up a little bit, because I'd imagine they're going to be very busy. But if you're not happy with that, you can always go to the CEO, go to ceoemail.com, find the CEO's email address, because I'm sure he would like to hear from customers, and make it very clear that your flight, the time, the day, when it was booked, how much you were delayed, and also evidence of everything that, you know, you've had to buy, because again, BA were not very forthcoming in giving vouchers or anything for food and drinks. As long as you've been reasonable, you're entitled to that money back. They have put on their website that you can claim for expenses, but I noticed on their website yesterday that it was saying, please try your travel insurance first. Well, actually, particularly if you've been flying in Europe, it's down to the airline. So the airline are still even trying to pass the buck and say, claim on your travel insurance. And that's still, even if you're outside of Europe, you can still claim, because it's part of the airline's terms and conditions that they will pay for the accommodation, they will pay for the travel, and they will pay for the refreshments. So always put it in writing and then say, if you're not happy with their response, that you will go to the Ombudsman, which is the Centre for Effective Resolution, Dispute Resolution. And then you can go to them. You wait your 8 weeks from the beginning of your complaint, or you ask for a deadlock letter. And again, if you're still not satisfied with that, it's not binding on the passenger, you can always go to the Sunwall Claims Court.
Well, lots of different steps there. Thank you for outlining them so succinctly. But using a claims website might strike some of our listeners as an easier way of doing this. But you're not a fan of those, the complaining cow.
No, I'm not. It's the ambulance chasers again, isn't it? It's the PPI of of the holiday industry. There's absolutely no need to use them. It's very, very easy. You just write to the airline and you say, this is the date, this is the flight, this is how much I was delayed. Under the EU regulations, please provide me with my due compensation. There is no need to be paying another claim company 25%.
Well, thanks very much there to Helen Dewdney, the consumer champion and complaining cow. You can read more about the fight for compensation in this weekend's edition of FT Money, and also check out the tips on Helen's website, thecomplainingcow.co.uk. Next week, a group of high-profile people are set to be made redundant, many on live television. I'm talking, of course, about politicians who stand to lose their seats at the general election. But what about the rest of us? The jobs market may appear robust, but the fear of redundancy is certainly growing. Could your family finances survive it? Knowing all the facts is the best way of preparing for the worst as you hope for the best, says Lindsay Cook, the FT's money mentor, who joins us in the studio now and has written about this feature this weekend. Lindsay, welcome to The Money Show.
Good morning.
So you're used to giving our readers financial advice through your column, but redundancy is a subject that you actually have a lot of personal experience about.
Yes, I have been made redundant 5 times. The first time, I actually left on a Friday and moved into a new job on a Monday. The second time, it was 2 weeks before I got another job. The third time, it was about 6 weeks, and it gets slower. I think that's probably with age, but also with employment markets recently. I have also made quite a few people redundant in various roles I've had, and I can say proudly that in one job I needed to lose 150 colleagues, and they were all voluntary.
Well, that's a really interesting insight into both sides of the redundancy process, which is what you've been writing about in this piece this week. So we've styled it up as the 10 questions you need to ask if you think that you're at risk or of redundancy or are facing redundancy for certain. And the first question that people are likely to ask is how much money they might expect to receive as a lump sum.
And that will vary. If you're in a low-paid job in the private sector, the National Redundancy Scheme, statutory scheme, is very niggardly. It pays a maximum of $14,600. If you've got 2 years' service under the age of 22, you just get 1 week's pay, which is not very much. But then it really varies according to the industry, what level you're at, what's in your contract. The best thing for anybody who's negotiating a job is to get the terms in the contract as they go in. Pay in lieu of notice in your contract is taxable, but you hope that you're going to have more than £30,000 of compensation, so it's not relevant because only the first £30,000 is tax-free. I've worked with people who've got 2 or 3 years' money, and that has been a very substantial sum and a life-changing sum. But the trend is that younger people tend to be offered redundancy because they haven't got the year's service and they haven't got the contracts with attractive terms.
Well, finally, voluntary redundancy. Now, this is something I know from the experience of friends, particularly those in the public sector at the moment, is on the rise. Could this be worth considering? I mean, it does present an opportunity, as you say, to potentially get your hands on a lump sum and then swiftly move into a new job.
It will depend. If you are likely to be able to swiftly move into another job, Rumours fly around companies long before the actual D-Day. And so if there's somebody thinking, do I want to go for volunteering? Test the market. See what's out there. Can you get a similar job? Is there interim work you can do? Do you want to do a year's travelling? I have funded quite a lot of gap years because people have decided, right, this industry is broken. I'm going to go away and think about what I want to do. So it's a matter of where it pays for you. Have you got a big mortgage? Is that insured? Have you got enormous credit card debts? Would redundancy clear those debts and you can be a new person and not have any debt in the future? It really depends on your circumstances and you need to do the maths before you actually volunteer for anything. And also, you may be able to negotiate slightly better terms. If it's quite a few people getting redundancy and it's all been negotiated with the board and everything, the actual terms, whether it's 2 weeks per year or whatever, are not likely to change. But you're likely to be able to get money for your silence if you're in a particular part of the industry that they don't want you gossiping about what's happened. Mm. You might be able to get outplacement. You may be able to get help with your CV. You'll definitely get legal fees if they want a compromise agreement. And it's up to you to think. If you're at a certain age, do you want them to pay a year of your pension contributions? It's you think, and it's the little side issues that nobody can later on say, oh, but you've discriminated because he, she got more than me.
Well, all very good advice there. Thanks very much to Lindsay Cook. You can read the full piece, Could Your Family Finances Survive Redundancy, in FT Money this weekend, or online from Friday at ft.com/money. Are tax-free savings a perk too far for the wealthy? Paul Lewis argues it's time to scrap the ISA. Would your finances survive being made redundant? And are all those pennies in your pocket really helping to look after the pounds? So, is it time to call time on the ISA? It may sound like anathema to some of our listeners, but Paul Lewis, the BBC journalist and Moneybox presenter, has penned a damning critique of the ISA in FT Money this week, and he thinks it's time to end the popular tax-free wrapper. He joins me now on the line to explain why. Welcome, Paul.
Hello, Claire.
So you've been looking into the history of tax-free savings accounts, and you think that what started off as a good thing is nowhere near such a good deal for savers today.
Yes, well, certainly not for ordinary savers. And when these were introduced, they were a revolution. It was John Major's Savers Budget in 1990. And we have the ISA now, but of course, the ISA was born from its aunt, Tessa. Tessa was the creation of John Major, tax-exempt special savings account. And at the time, it was very valuable because, believe it or not, Claire, at the time, interest rates peaked on savings accounts at 13.5%, and the basic rate of tax was 25%. So earning all that interest and getting tax relief on it was a really big deal. So savers did put money in, and you could put up to 9,000 into it over 5 years, which was a lot of money then. But even if you put modest amounts in, it was worth it because you got that tax relief. So it really was a good deal then. But over the last quarter of a century, it really has declined in its importance.
Well, you've been doing some research, and the best deals on cash ISAs today obviously are a pale shadow of those healthy sounding rates, but there are other factors that have also dulled the appeal.
There are, and you know, they used to try and attract us by putting rates on ISAs higher than those on ordinary savings accounts. You remember it's the ISA season, get your money into the ISA. If you look at putting your money away for a year or two, which is probably the sensible thing to do if you're putting it into an ISA or a savings account, you can get, over 2 years, you can now earn 1.76%. That's with Charter Savings Bank. Even after tax, that's 1.41%. But the Best Buy 2-year ISA, that's with Britannia, is only paying 1.25%. So in an ISA, you're getting less than you would get in a non-ISA, even if you pay tax on it. Now, most people don't pay tax on their savings anymore because we now have the £1,000 savings allowance for everyone who just pays basic rate tax. And so you have to have a lot of savings at current rates to go above your savings allowance. So for most people, 95%, the Treasury says, for most people, the interest on their savings, even in regular accounts, is tax-free. And as I said, even if it's not, you would still find that you were better off outside an ISA than inside an ISA.
Now, whoever the next Chancellor is, they're obviously going to have some tough decisions about how to balance the books. And lots of our listeners, of course, will have stocks and shares ISAs, which are becoming increasingly popular because the cash ISA rates are so low and it's harder to save into a pension for the wealthy. But you also think that we should do away with those.
Well, yes, because, again, you get, at the moment, £5,000 of your dividend payments are free of tax. Now, that implies, at sort of typical dividend returns on FTSE shares, it would take more than £140,000 in shares to earn more than £5,000. So, for most ordinary savers, their dividends are tax-free anyway. Now, there were plans to cut that to £2,000. We don't know if that's going to happen. It depends who wins the election and, as you say, who's Chancellor and what they decide. But most of your dividends are tax-free anyway, just as most of your cash interest is tax-free outside an ISA. So I don't see the point of them. The only people who benefit from ISAs are the people who've got six-figure sums in savings, more than six-figure sums in shares, and they are the wealthy. ISAs are a tax shelter for the wealthy. Their purpose has gone. They don't help ordinary savers. And my view, if I was Chancellor, though I have to say there is very little chance of that, I would scrap the ISA and perhaps increase the tax-free allowances on savings. So maybe all savings interest was tax-free. And then you'd get rid of all this complexity.
Well, thanks very much there to Paul Lewis, presenter of Moneybox, and his column in FT Money you can read online now, ft.com/money. Is it time to scrap the ISA? That's all from The Money Show this week. If you've got a story you'd like the FT Money team to follow up, or a question to pose to our team of financial experts, then get in touch. Email us, money@ft.com, tweet us @FTMoney, or comment on our articles online at ft.com/money. We will be back next Thursday at the usual time. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost £27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.